do solemnly swear
that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States
against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same.
That I take this obligation freely
without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion.
And that I will well and faithfully discharge
the duties of the office on which I am about to enter.
So help me God.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Welcome to The Oath. I'm Chuck Rosenberg, and I am honored to be your host for another compelling conversation with a fascinating guest from the world of public service. This week, The Oath ventures into orbit. My guest is Kathy Sullivan, a former NASA astronaut and the first American woman to walk in space. An oceanographer by training and an explorer at heart, Kathy was selected into a new class of NASA astronauts in 1978, an exceedingly competitive and rigorous process that included the first six women ever admitted to the highly selective program. After years of intensive training and simulations, Kathy ultimately flew three missions for NASA on the space shuttle, including her 1984 spacewalk and the 1990 mission that deployed the Hubble Space Telescope, one of the most advanced and important scientific achievements in the history of NASA. After leaving NASA, Kathy ran the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, a crucial part of the Department of Commerce that houses, among other agencies, the National Weather Service. In June of 2020, after this episode was recorded, Kathy became the first woman to reach the deepest spot in the ocean, a nearly 7-mile descent to the Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific Ocean. That makes Kathy the only person ever to walk in space and to dive to the ocean's deepest known point. Kathy Sullivan, welcome to The Oath.
Thanks, good to be here.
It's a real pleasure to have you. Tell me where you grew up.
6 years in northern New Jersey, where my dad was in the early stages of his aerospace career. And then in 1958, we drove across the country and settled in Southern California, San Fernando Valley, outside of Los Angeles.
When I was a child, I wanted to be an astronaut. I know many people who shared that dream. You became an astronaut, but that's not what you wanted to be when you were little.
Well, I wanted to be lots of things, I think, when I was little, but mainly I didn't have labels for what I wanted to be. I had impulses that were very strong, geographic impulses, what I would call them now, but curiosity about what's out there, what's it like at the top of that hill, intense and insatiable curiosity around maps and the stories that they tell. You know, what I wanted was somehow to have all that stuff a part of my life. And what I didn't know was what kind of job label, title, meant you got to do that.
You didn't know what it was called, but you know which way you wanted to go.
I knew what I wanted it to be like, but I didn't know what you called it.
You tell a story in your wonderful book, Handprints on Hubble, about being a 7-year-old and planning a family trip to the Sierra Nevada mountains.
Yeah, it was, I think, the first summer, maybe the second, that we were out there, and my dad had made a friend that was into trout fishing, which my father had gotten interested in. And so it was decided the two families would rent a cabin together and head up into the mountains. And I this was probably some quick conversation at dinner one evening. We're going to go with the Parkers to Lake Sabrina. Okay, that sounds great. After dinner, I think it was, went out to the car in the glove box and got out the gas station map and unfolded it. And I already knew enough. This is all thanks to my father, I'm sure, to look at the back where the names were all listed and find the name and find the two coordinates and find the letter and the number and, you know, triangulate my way in. And, you know, boom, there's the lake and boom, here's where we are. And this is before freeways were built in California. So there's a limited set of routes to get to anywhere. And this had a very prominent interstate highway running right up that side of the mountain. So I traced all that out, was very proud of myself. And when we then left for the mountains, I don't remember how long the time was between my map quest and the departure. But we're driving away in the olden days, pre-bucket seats. My brother and I are in the back seat, big bench seat car.
No seatbelts,
of course. No seatbelts, no. My dad asked my mom to get the map out of the glove box, and he knew the surface streets to get to the north end of our valley, but then which road and on from there. And I pulled myself up on the back of their seat and pronounced that 395 will get us there. And they chuckled. That was so cute that she was trying to help as my mother's wrestling the map. And a few minutes later, she looks over at my father with this shocked look on her face and says, she's right. Like, how did she do that?
So you had plotted the family trip, you just didn't share it with them yet.
I had just my own curiosity of where is that and traced back to said, oh, okay, well, I guess we'll probably do this. And then, you know, like 7-year-olds will do, got distracted into 43 other things and it didn't come back to mind until the question came up as we were driving away.
Of course, but I hope they listened to you.
They did, yeah. I think I was dubbed the navigator probably from that day forward.
You write in your book that you were very close with your mother's mother, your maternal grandmother, and that she died when you were 12 in 1963, and that turned your world upside down.
Yeah, it turned our family world upside down. She's the only one of my four grandparents I had any chance to get to know. Both grandfathers had died long before my brother and I came along. My father's mother is a dim figure in my memory from probably an age where I was a toddler on the floor and watching my slightly older brother play with Nana. So Pauline was the one I got to know. Not long after we moved to Southern California, she packed up from Jackson Heights, New York, and came out and lived nearby for, you know, probably 3 to 4 years, I would guess the time frame was. And it was delightful. I mean, to, you know, Grandma babysitting, Nana babysitting. Nana's apartment was a few blocks away from where we lived for quite some time. And in those early Southern California days, as a 7, 8, 9-year-old, you could blithely set off at the crack of dawn and come back at supper time and just wander and roam in the hills. And, you know, it was great to have this extra waypoint where there were bound to be some nice cookies, a couple hugs, fun lady to stop in and visit. So it's, you know, a delightful memory from that sort of classically perfect time to really be in love with a grandparent. And then on top of that, it's the only grandparent experience I had, given how our family went.
But you lost her suddenly.
Yeah, it was quite a sudden matter of weeks, maybe a couple of months, between a day at her apartment where she was stricken and my mother, you know, scraped her up off the floor and summoned, I guess, the ambulance, and we got her into hospital. She lived through that following Christmas and then passed away in March of the following year. And as a, you know, 12 or 13-year-old who's really been doted on by this delightful Nana, that was quite a loss. But took a couple months after that, I think, for me to realize that however it all had worked on my mother herself, and I'm not, you know, not going to try to do speculative psychoanalysis here, but something really had ripped more fundamentally for my mother with that loss. And it catapulted her into bouts with depression, some damaging drinking that went on for many, many years. And the depression really never quite left her. I think it sort of got better and she regained good functionality, but she was a deeply tired soul when that was all done. Never quite the same again.
You ended up going to the University of California at Santa Cruz. What did you study there?
I went there because they had an outstanding Russian language program. And my game plan at the time, having already become fluent in French and right on the cusp of fluent in German, but Russian was the, you know, strategically significant language of the day with the politics of the world at the time. And it had this crazy Cyrillic alphabet, which just seemed an intriguing puzzle to learn how to solve.
A fascinating thing.
Fascinating thing. So that was going to be my next move, was to get fluent in Russian. And again, I still didn't know what that meant I was going to do with all of this. In fact, college was where I only just began to take a deeper look and think about, well, what do you do if these are the skills you have? You can speak multiple languages. You can teach them. You can read and analyze the literature in them. You can be a translator or an interpreter. That could be an asset for being in the Foreign Service. But I was just sort of starting to think through what life might be like down those avenues when I enrolled in college.
Had you thought about the Foreign Service?
You know, I had thought about it a tiny little bit, sparked completely by James Michener's book, Caravans, which I think I had read in about sixth grade. So a very, very sort of vague and romanticized view of the kind of adventurous life a Foreign Service officer might have. Not quite getting at the paperwork and back in the embassy drudge that any job like that probably entails as well. So freshman year, I was just beginning to meet people that could help shed some light on those sorts of things. Other senior students around me were applying for Foreign Service and taking the exam. So I was beginning to get windows on what these avenues of life might be like, if in fact my skill set was languages. But my general plan to max up on languages and switch quickly to Russian was subverted by my French advisor, who informed me I was required to take 3 science courses. But I have a plan and I've mapped things out. And, you know, as God does when you say, I have a plan, he just laughed and said, yeah, that's nice. You're taking three courses. And here, I recommend these three, by the way. They're actually interesting and they're well taught. Everyone's enjoyed them and gotten something out of them. And they're demonstrably not too hard for French majors and language majors to pass. So get ye across the campus and take these classes.
And what were they?
The first one was an introductory course to marine biology taught by a professor named Todd Newberry. Youngish guy, I guess he was probably early 30s at the time he's teaching this. Very passionate about his field and, you know, lots of weekend stints out in the tide pools and along the coast, getting the hands-on, up-close look at the things that we were studying about. The only book he used for that course was not a textbook, but really a memoir cum research cruise report written by a Brit named Alistair Hardy, who got the chance when he was 26 years old to go on an extended voyage with the Royal Research Ship Discovery. His book it's about one-third a coming-of-age tale of this young British man from sort of nowhere having suddenly this great experience, and it's one-third a sailing travelogue, and then it's one-third a, you know, intrigue of how do you do science at sea. That was like a full-painted portrait of the kind of life I had sort of been dreaming of since reading Caravans and way back when.
You just didn't have a name for it.
I didn't have a name for it, and so, you know, here's a guy standing in front of me in the lecture hall and taking me out to the tide pools, and then here's a sort of larger canvas described in this book of the kind of life this is, and that was great. And then a very forgettable theoretical math class, sort of topology and shapes in between. And the third one was a general broad sweep oceanography course, so the geology and the physics and the chemistry and a little bit of the biology again, taught by a guy named Gary Griggs. And same thing, passionate, young, dynamic professor. And finally, as that course is nearing its end, so it's my final quarter of freshman year, I've checked the box on the science requirements. And what am I now going to do with this? Because I'm loving this stuff every bit as much as I've ever loved my language studies.
Were you surprised?
Delighted is more the word. I mean, it was certainly unexpected, but I just blew right past any sort of surprise and was into eagerness, I think, the whole way through. And so I think I was starting to kind of realize you've got to start figuring out what you're taking sophomore year. You're saying this was fun and it's great and now I have, you know, something I'll read for my hobbies and I'm going back to the Russian pathway, or what are you going to do here? And I stewed on that for a while and realized I didn't really know how to answer that, because I knew I had liked two classes, but I didn't really know what going down the road of oceanography would mean. And so one day, as our class was ending, I lingered behind a little bit and asked Gary Griggs, we've tease each other and reminisce about this frequently, that because these were not very intelligently posed questions. They were very sincere questions, but not well put. I mean, I always said, I think I basically said, I liked that course and I liked this course. What do you guys actually do? I mean, that's about as smart as my question was. You know, the lesson for me from that day is there's a sincere question badly put, which really complex and sincere questions are often really hard to put right. Ask it of someone who will respond to the question underneath and not, you know, not unduly penalize you or laugh at you or, you know, just make jokes about how badly you put it.
Someone who's really listening.
Someone who's got the care and the compassion to respond to the human, that there's a deep human question here that came out badly. And we joke about now how badly it came out, but I promise you, if he had laughed and snickered at my naive, klutzy way of asking it, I'm sure I would have been devastated and embarrassed and slunk back to the French department. But happily, I picked a guy like Gary Griggs who would understand and appreciate the question underneath the clumsy words and really respond generously and passionately to that. And instead of, as he well could have done, pointing out what sort of chasm exists between a just barely 18-year-old French major who didn't take the high school math and science prereqs and a professor. I mean, it's a massive chasm. You possibly imagine you could become like me. His attitude and his response was more like, oh man, it is so fun on this side of the chasm. Let me show you how to build a bridge.
Come follow me.
Come follow me. You'll love it.
And you loved it.
Never looked back.
In fact, you went on to get a PhD in oceanography at Dalhousie?
Yes.
Did I pronounce that right?
Yeah, you did. Most people don't. Well done.
Tell me about that.
I had figured out by the end of my undergraduate that the geology and structure of the seafloor was really what fascinated me. you know, the structure of the Atlantic Ocean and Pacific Ocean geologically are quite different. So you sort of kind of pick which class, which group of features and phenomena you want to try to understand and study. I had spent my third year of university on an exchange program in Bergen, Norway. And so I really sort of had the geology of the Atlantic sort of open up in front of me. Plate tectonics was just really getting underway and getting established as a working model at that time. And it was all happening right off my doorstep from Bergen, Norway. I wanted to do the geology and geophysics of the oceans, and I was just more intrigued by the mid-ocean ridges in the Atlantic and the way the continents, the continental margins there. So I was inclined towards Atlantic Ocean stuff. And I had graduate school offers on both the West Coast and the East Coast. But Dalhousie had a really good group of researchers.
We should mention it's in Nova Scotia.
It's in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Really good set of researchers and a very good collaboration with the Bedford Institute of Oceanography. That was at the time Canada's only oceanographic institution. And I'd read a number of the papers that these people were putting out. Their work seemed really interesting. One of my professors at Santa Cruz knew some of them and spoke well of them. You know, it seemed a more interesting place to live. Grad school's kind of an experiment in living. Go somewhere for 4 to 5 years and maybe move on from there, maybe end up staying. So it just, Nova Scotia was intriguing. The Atlantic was intriguing. The group was intriguing. And then the icing on the cake was the professor who was going to bring me into his lab as a research student offered me the chance to do some field work for him on a research ship between Greenland and Iceland the summer that I was going to start with port calls in Reykjavik, Iceland. And Iceland is such an intriguing area geologically that I was already all in for Dalhousie, but then there's, wait, I can go to Iceland? Yeah.
It just keeps getting better.
I'm up. Yep, let's go.
You wrote that you love going to sea and that you analogized successful research expeditions to a symphony. What do you mean by that?
I'm taken with the analogy of shuttle flights or research expeditions at sea to symphonies, because some people, when they watch them from the outside, you know, it seems quite regimented, you know, very perfunctory, run your checklist, do everything just right. But research cruises and shuttle missions, for that matter, in my day, you know, they started with blank sheets of paper. Okay, we're going to go up to the North Atlantic. We're going to try to figure out how X works. And then you create the cruise. You're not handed something to perform. You get a group of researchers or you get a team together. And if that's what we're trying to do, if that's what we're trying to measure, if this is what we're trying to understand, what gear do we need? Will it work at sea? Can we make it wire in with the ship? How do we need to operate it? How do we wire it to the lab? You actually create all that. And you're writing the how to do it. And then you actually go out to sea with all that gear and best laid plans. You never fully survive contact with reality. The weather goes bad or something breaks down and you're always having to adapt and adjust and be creative again to recapture the purpose that you were after in the first place. The analogy has struck me as I think about musicians and watch symphonies that, you know, someone composed that score. So if
from a blank sheet of
from
paper.
A blank sheet of paper. So imagine, I mean, if you pick up an instrument, I've just the snippets of musical experience myself, it can be laborious to try to learn how to make your clarinet or flute do what the score on the page in front of you says. It's extraordinary when you get to where you have the skill to play masterful pieces. But if you wrote that score, you imagined it in your mind, you heard it and you layered all the instruments together, and then you're up on the podium conducting it. It's magical, this thing that was just an idea in your mind that got onto page, that got into the skilled hands of many other people to bring it to full fruition. There you go. And putting missions together at sea and in space struck me as much the same kind of creative construct. And then to see it all play out and actually be in the middle of it, helping it go right, despite the broken string or the busted part, it's an exhilarating, it's a spectacular fun experience.
So explorers like to explore. You're doing this thing that you love. You studied oceanography. You're an oceanographer. Is that the bridge between ocean and space that explorers love to explore?
I think there are two parts to the bridge. The motivational part is that one, the exploration, the explorer's curiosity. And for me, the particular point on that would be if you somehow survived the odds, this very slim odds of getting selected out of thousands of people who want to go, you'd get to see the Earth with your own eyes from that vantage point. And for a kiddo whose fascination really rooted in the Earth from, you know, when I was 2 feet tall, that's just irresistible as motives go. But the other bridge, the more practical bridge, what I suspect is the bridge that NASA recognized, is the expeditionary experience. Putting expeditions together, what's the objective, what's the plan, what do you need to do it, how do you make sure it works? Thinking through several what-ifs so that when you're 500 miles offshore, even when this what-if happens, you can still fix it, you can adapt, you can carry on. And despite, you know, whatever the weather and other things throw at you, despite that, you'll come back with highly successful crews.
I understand what sparked your interest, but when did it occur to you, Kathy, that you wanted to apply to be an astronaut?
It occurred to me when I saw one of NASA's ads in the back of a scientific journal, and the way they described it in that ad rang the bell for me that these guys are building a very different, very exotic research ship. It's going to go vertical off the planet and way faster than any ship I've ever worked on before. But from a purpose point of view, that's basically what they're doing. They're going to have this crazy cool new research ship. And they're looking for people to help plan and pull together and then operate the expeditions. And that's what I loved about being an oceanographer, was that part in particular of the endeavor.
The odds of being selected as an astronaut are pretty small.
There were close to 9,000 people that applied in our batch, and 35 made it through.
Among the 35 were 6 women, the first women ever selected as astronauts by NASA.
Correct.
And in your book, you write that they asked you a particular question during your interview. Simply, tell us about yourself. Start in high school.
The interview was a number of months prior to that, November of 77, a classically unstructured question. So this is a high-stakes interview. You've gotten to the final couple hundred people, so you're close.
Were you nervous?
I will get nervous at moments like that beforehand and afterhand, because somewhere in my mind, it is clear, even just subconsciously. But right now, the important thing is we need to do our best. You can be nervous or afraid before, you can be nervous or afraid after, but right now, we need to be all in right now, this moment, and give it your best. Walk out the door and collapse if you have to, but let's be on, let's be here, let's really do this. Certainly aware that this is clearly the pivotal thing. The doctors and medics looking at you can take you off the list and deem you not qualified. How you get onto the final list hinges mainly on this interview. So we all kind of had surmised that. And if you're even being interviewed at that point, they've determined at the 99% level, you're a good person who could do this job. But now I only got 20 seats for 200 people, so which 20 are going to make it? That's going to hinge on the interview.
And so the question they asked you, tell us about yourself, start in high school. What are they getting at?
I think what they're getting at and wanting to see with that unstructured question, when there's a lot riding on this moment, you know it's a high-stakes moment, you care a lot about how it comes out. It's not clear what the ground rules are. It's not clear what the judging criteria are. None of that is known to you at all. So now I'm going to ask you this ginormous question. I mean, I was 26. Other people had lived, you know, 20 years more than I. I'm going to ask you this ginormous question at a high-stakes moment, and I'm going to watch how you handle yourself. Can you quickly conceive of sort of a storyline of some sort that you've judged has good likelihood of being germane to this moment and this audience and lay that out? And do you seem to be able to stay aware of the audience around you and sort of paying attention to whether they're listening, that your answer's engaging them, you're losing them? I think they're kind of looking for those sorts of behavioral characteristics.
When I was United States attorney and I was interviewing people for a very coveted position, the question I would always start with was, tell me your story, because I wanted to see what their narrative was, whether it was linear or thematic, how they thought about their lives, their advantages, their failures. What was the 45-second synopsis?
However long is significant, too, because we've all known plenty of people that I have my narrative, but it's my narrative, and it's a very fulsome narrative, and I'm insensitive to the circumstance. I'm insensitive to this moment. I use the phrase in the book that we use commonly around the astronaut corps. Does this person stuck in transmit? You know, once I have the mic, I'm just going and I lose all situational awareness around me. No sense of any other people.
How did you learn you were selected to be an astronaut? Because that's a big deal, Kathy.
Yeah, it's a cold call early in the morning, it turns out. I was living in Halifax, Nova Scotia at the time, still in grad school at Dalhousie. And Halifax is on the Atlantic time zone, so it's an hour ahead of East Coast U.S. And the 35 lucky folks who were going to be in our class were on a call sheet for our boss. He, of course, the boss reserves the right to call and give the happy news. And someone else was calling all the other people. They knew when they were planning to put out a press release sometime that morning and wanted to be sure that no one who was going to be selected learned it by the press release dropping, but they had some moments to be ready for what was going to turn out to be a remarkable media frenzy that I had no real way to anticipate. I want to say it was around 7 in the morning, Halifax time, so 6 a.m. East Coast time. And I was sharing an apartment, as you do when you're broken in grad school, with 3 or 4 other gals, and rooms along a long hallway, one common phone. And the phone rang at 7 in the morning, which we all sprang out of our doors because none of our schoolmates are up at that time. If that phone's ringing, it's probably some family call, and it might well be bad news. And so everyone's on very much on edge. I forget which of my roommates grabbed the phone and then turned and looked at me with, you know, not a devastated, Kathy's going to be horrified look on her face, covering the mouthpiece. It's someone from NASA. Okay. But, you know, it had been months since we had interviewed, and I'd been buried back in writing my thesis, and I had not been spending every day sitting around wondering whether the phone would ring or which way this was going
to
go.
And there was no reason to expect a call that day.
No, we'd been given no knowledge of what the timing might be, so it was just out of the blue. And on the other end of the phone was a gentleman named George Abbey, an iconic figure in the human spaceflight world of NASA. He was the head of flight crew operations at the time. He's notorious for having a very low bass, kind of droll voice. So he starts in, this is George Abbey, and, well, we were wondering if you were still interested in coming to Houston and joining us as an astronaut. And my first thought was, that's about as much excitement as if you're inviting me to bag groceries at the nearby market. I mean, wouldn't you? Sure, George, I'd be happy to.
But yes.
The answer would be yes.
The answer is yes.
Yeah. I probably exchanged one or two other sentences, and then he said, this was an equally funny moment to me at the time, oh, I'm sure you have many questions about salary and benefits. I'll pass you over to someone else. I was grossing about $3,000 U.S. per year at that point, and actually living quite comfortably on that. And I was really sure they were not going to pay me less. So, and I'd never had insurance or benefits, so this was all Greek to me. I said, yeah, my answer is not at all dependent on what comes after this.
In other words, you had no questions about salaries and benefits.
I have no questions. There's no way it's going to be lower than this.
When did the 35 new astronauts gather and where?
They asked us to come down to Houston. That was the February 1978 event for a meeting everybody and being presented publicly to the press.
Did you also take an oath of office?
Of course, going into the civil service position, so you swear the oath of service. They wanted to get us all together and do a little PR moment, announce the class, big news, and big part of the drum roll to getting the shuttle up into the air. And then they also wanted to get us together as a batch so that all the administrivia, the HR, the preparations for us to be on board could all get done in a batch. We were charged with reporting formally for duty in June. So this was just get the prelims out of the way and do some publicity.
And when you report in June, you're an ASCAN. You're an astronaut candidate. You're not actually an astronaut yet.
A distinction the outside world scarcely bothers with, but has some important significance inside the office. What it really means, it's not a probationary period in a strict sense. They're not planning on washing half of you out and, you know, winnowing the group further down. But it is sort of a boot camp grad school for astronauts. It's a supercharging you with a dose of graduate-level education, condensed graduate-level education, in every facet of science, technology, medicine that you could imagine has any bearing on spaceflight. So I was trained as an oceanographer and an earth scientist, rounding me out so that I've got some depth of knowledge of spacecraft engineering, spaceflight physiology, orbital mechanics, and taking the fighter pilot and rounding them out, and the medical doctor and rounding them out, and getting you up to speed on the flight qualifications in the T-38 jets and other basic things like that. And helping you learn the agency, because even if you're the newest astronaut on the planet, you're already one of NASA's best ambassadors. So let's be sure you have a good foundation of all of the science and engineering broadly, and that you've been trooped around to the different NASA centers and become acquainted with what all the different parts of NASA do.
We get support from Policy Genius. With everything going on right now, a lot of people are asking if it's even possible to buy life insurance at all. The short answer is yes. You can buy life insurance during a pandemic. And if you have loved ones depending on your income, you probably should. As an insurance marketplace, Policy Genius is in contact with the life insurance companies on their platform every day. They're keeping track of all the changes in the market, which means they can get you covered quickly and for the best price. Here's how it works. Policy Genius compares quotes from the top life insurance companies in one place to help you find your best price. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and red tape for free. So if you're one of the many people looking to buy life insurance right now, but you're not sure where to start, head to policygenius.com. The folks at Policy Genius will find you the best rate and handle the process completely. They'll get you and your family protected and hopefully give you one less thing to worry about.
I imagine it's both exhilarating and intimidating to be around these 34 other people, all extraordinarily accomplished, like you were, but from different walks of life with a different set of experiences than you had.
You know, it's a bunch of one percenters. Everyone in that group is used to being the one percenter in whatever class or workplace they're in, and now they're in a pool that's all one percenters, and it's a pretty competitive pool. You are colleagues, but you're also peer competitors. Everyone's eager for the first flight and the best flight and the early flight. And again, the ground rules for that competition. How are we being evaluated? What factors will go into who's selected for which flight? All a black box. None known. Lots of speculation over beers. No grading sheet, no rubric out there, so you could know for sure how this is all working.
What you're really describing as part of the training is that astronauts are generalists and system operators and not specialists.
I was not hired as an astronaut to continue doing my oceanography from space. I was hired to help take payloads, cargoes, experiments that needed to get into outer space to work or to be conducted, and on behalf of the teams that had built those, take them to orbit, operate them, bring back the data or the equipment.
Glad you mentioned teams, because you emphasized in your book, I think over and over, that it really is a team. You use the word we a lot when you talk about your time as an astronaut.
It absolutely is a team sport. An astronaut in a nice blue flight suit has a lot of responsibility, is an iconic figure. It's sort of one of the figures that the teams all gravitate around. But in fact, astronauts have no managerial control over anybody but themselves. So you have a lot of influence and authority by influence, but not by direct control. But you, in your role as an astronaut, one of the key things you're doing is playing that catalytic role of helping make sure the pieces are coming together. The unknowns are being probed carefully. The risks are being evaluated carefully. Sort of part of that catalyst right in the middle of it all.
In fact, the first sentence of your book, the only thing we truly do alone is have the start of a good idea.
I don't remember where that came from or how it got coined into quite those words, but it's something I believe deeply.
After a year, you graduate from being an astronaut candidate to being an astronaut. What happens at that point? What do you start to do in order to train to go into space?
It's an interesting progression. When we got our little silver pin that said we had finished our prep school, as it were, and we now were astronauts.
And by the way, you don't get a gold pin until you actually go up.
That's right. So it's silver, and we'll stop calling you ASCAN. And technically what that means is you are now considered eligible for a flight assignment. But when we made that transition, there were still, as it turns out, two more years before the shuttle would fly at all. And then we were in line behind folks who had been in the office for a long time waiting their turn. So what do we do in those intervening years, which turned out to be 1979 to 1983? And the answer is something NASA calls technical assignments. So for 12, 14, 16 months or so, each of us would be plunked into some part of the working machinery of the space shuttle program. You might be working in a simulator that's tailored to software verification. You might be working with one of the crews that was assigned to the earliest flights as they get the checklist for those flights refined and verified and validated and sorted out. The crew members that are going to fly need to be in the simulator honing their actual on-orbit skills and the follow-up to get what they learned into the checklist or to get the change made. That follow-up needs to be in someone else's hands. That would be a technical assignment. There are countless different things to do. So over that 3 or 4 year period, we would be rotated on a 12 to 18 month cycle, thrown into the swimming pool, learn this whole part of the world rapidly, be effective, work on it. And right about when you're getting comfortable, they'd plunk you out and stick you in another one. I liken it to starting your path towards the top of a company by working in the mailroom and then in shared services and then in HR and then in engineering support. So that by the time you're running a business unit or in charge of the company, you've got a much deeper understanding of what the mechanics that you're counting on really take to work.
And so for different shuttle missions, before you actually flew on one, you would have different assignments to support each one.
It might be the next flight up or one or two downstream, but there's also a long list of cargoes that are being planned for flights that are maybe 2 years or 3 years out. Another technical assignment might be go work with the group that's building the XYZ satellite. They intend for it to be deployed with the robotic arm, or they intend for spacewalking astronauts to be able to do X and Y and Z to it. You go be their basically their design consultant and technical advisor and make sure they understand the shuttle and the realities of working in a spacesuit. So you go through that continuous tumbler of different jobs. That's technical assignment is basically the waiting pool for getting plucked out and put by name onto a particular flight. And when that happens, a whole new syllabus starts that begins with your basic knowledge of the fundamentals of how space shuttle systems work. And over at least a 12-month span, sometimes longer, your training sessions, little bits of book work, but mainly simulation training sessions, deepen and sharpen your knowledge from the general state of the electrical system works like this to the particulars that are exact to your mission. On your flight, this electrical bus will be connected to that device with that fuse, and you have how many ways to keep it running if the fuse goes.
NASA numbers their flights, and you tell a story about having a particular assignment for STS-3. What was STS-3?
So STS stood for Space Transportation System, the shuttle. Think of it like equivalent to the Navy's USS in front of all of their vessels. So STS meant the shuttle as well as the external. It was the whole system that would get a shuttle to and from orbit. We began with just a sequential, you know, -1, -2, -3. You might lay them out in a nice linear sequence from, say, 1 to 10 or 12. But if something went wrong with the cargo that was meant to be on number 6 and needed to be delayed, you'd maybe end up with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, 5. At one point, the NASA higher-ups decided that's just going to end up being way too confusing. You know, people are not going to understand that we laid them out this way and now it's all been jumbled. So a new system was devised. It was alleged would be simpler and clearer, but I think just confounded the problem by times three. We're not going to give you a number. We're going to give you a code. My first flight was STS-41G. 4 will tell you what space shuttle it's going to be, Columbia, da 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 da. 1 would tell you whether it was launching from the East Coast or the West Coast, because it was envisioned Vandenberg would become a shuttle launch site. And the alphabetic letter would tell you when we laid out the flights for that year initially, where were you in the sequence, A, B, C, D, E, F, G? And then when things start scrambling around, since no one could figure out the code for the beginning, they wouldn't worry about why they were all scrambled around.
But early on, they just did it numerically, ordinally.
Just ordinally through STS-10.
But STS-3 had a story, which I think is important because it's a story of failure, which we all have. Because you were asked in this particular case to be responsible for the shuttle cockpit's checklist.
In the countdown leading up to a shuttle launch, and as it happens at a moment that very often fell in the deep dark middle of the night, the task was for two astronauts, not the crew, but two astronauts, you know, on technical assignments to get in the cockpit and work with the launch control center to go through every single switch and circuit breaker in the entire cockpit. That's probably 1,500 or 1,600 gadgets, and confirm that each and every one of them was in the position it ought to be for liftoff. That the ascent checklist and all of the procedures presume that every switch is just like this.
And that has to be done manually.
It's got to be done manually. And it's got to be a 100% one-for-one match for what the crew is expecting and what's in their checklists, and because things are going to go really fast once you light those rockets. So I was in the cockpit that night before STS-3 launch with Lauren Shriver. We were the two folks tapped to do this. And the procedure for getting all these steps done in the countdown was still pretty rough. It was early days in the shuttle program, and you'd find an error or something unexpected in the procedure. An engineer would see something on their console they didn't expect, and everything would come to a halt while everybody figured that out and made sure that everything was ready to carry on again. that happened notoriously during the switchless. So you've got two of us and engineering tech in the cockpit. It's the middle of the night. We're partway through this, and one of these big halts comes up. And we're just trying to stay awake and not get drowsy and not fall asleep. And we did get very, very drowsy. So the next thing, finally, after a long delay, the voice of launch control comes up and asks for another switch position. And it's one of the ones in the area of the cockpit I'm working. So I stumble up and rouse myself and go to push the button and answer, hey, got it. Wait a minute. Give me a second. Odd bit of trivia. We would do most of the switch list with a microphone button that would clip to our shirts and just connected only to the launch control center. The pause had come right after we shifted over to test the communication system on the space shuttle itself. So now the button to push to talk on the microphone was on the control stick of the shuttle. And that stick has two buttons. One, like where a trigger would be, is the comms button, and one on the top, a little beanie hat kind of button. Well, every airplane I've ever flown had, and the ones I'd been in for 1,500 hours, the T-38s, have the same two switches. In the T-38, the trigger one under your index finger is useless. It doesn't do anything. And the communication is the little red one on top. I grab the control stick and I start pushing the little red button that's going to open up my microphone. Even as I'm pushing it, some part of my brain is saying, this is unusually stiff. But I push it, and the next thing I know, the whole cockpit lights up like a Christmas tree. And I realize the reason the switch was too stiff is because that red button on the space shuttle is the one that kills the main computers and tells the backup computer to take over. This is the mega emergency switch. You know, all four of your normal computers have gone insane, and you want to kill them right away and let the other guy take you home. That's the switch I had just pushed.
Also known as the wrong switch?
Also known as the wrong switch. So, you know, I'm mortified. I figure I probably just destroyed my career with this stupid move. The only good news is completely reversible. You just needed to be sure that you confess, because if the world was left to imagine that maybe there's a software flaw inside the computers that did this when we didn't want it to, that we would ground the whole fleet until we figured that out. So I really had no choice but to confess, tell the control center, nope, it's a cockpit error. Software's fine. This is not a gremlin. This is not an anomaly. This is a boo-boo. And we went laboriously back through all the steps to get back to where we needed to be. Finally, we were relieved and could leave the cockpit and, you know, went back to the control center and talked everybody through it again to be sure they really understood it's all good. And then went off to, you know, meet my fate, which fretted about for a long time.
I understand that the launch control team handled it well. They gave you a gift.
They did. The shuttle lifted off on time, everything fine the next day. And we'd always have a post-launch party. Everyone's worked really hard. I dreaded going to that party, but figured any ribbing I was going to get was going to start there, and you know, you're better facing it than running from it. So yeah, I didn't expect the gift, but they'd quickly made a small metal box that had two red buttons on it, one labeled this switch and the other one labeled not that switch, and you know, presented it with a giggle. They knew that this was far from the only oopsie that had ever happened in switch list, and far from the only oopsie an astronaut had ever done, but you know, I was convinced it was the biggest oopsie ever known to man.
You were mortified.
I was mortified, yeah.
But actually, not long thereafter, you do get assigned to your first shuttle.
Yes, it was not all that long afterward.
STS-41G.
41G with a lot of Earth science experiments on it, which was right up my alley and probably a significant factor. I was the only geologist in the bunch at that point, so probably a significant factor in why I was slotted into that flight.
Kathy, this is from a description of a different mission, but I love the way you capture the sensation of liftoff. You wrote in your book, I closed my eyes and took in the sounds and sensations of a space shuttle launch. For the first 2 minutes and 15 seconds, the ride was turbulent and loud, like being in a wild combination of earthquake, rock concert, and fighter jet. The vibrations were almost bone-rattling, the thrust pushing upward through my back strong and constant. I felt the thrust tailing off, heard the mission pilot report that the solid rockets were burning out as expected, and then heard the thump that announced they had been jettisoned. Now the ride seemed quiet and as smooth as an electric train. The push against my back continued as the main engines accelerated us toward orbital velocity. When the engines cut off 6 minutes later, the lightness in my limbs and the checklists floating at the end of their tethers confirmed that I was back in orbit. I felt instantly at home.
It's a great ride.
On that mission, you performed, and it's a clunky term, an extravehicular activity.
That's why we call it EVA.
Right, spacewalk.
Yep.
And you became the first American woman ever to walk in space. How do you train for a spacewalk?
The primary way you train for a spacewalk is underwater. There's a batch of real shuttle spacewalking spacesuits that have been earmarked for the water tank. They're never going to actually fly in space, but they're the real garment. You take the real electronics off of the front and the back, and you replace them with shapes that mimic the bulk that you will have in the suit.
That's your Class 3 spacesuit.
Yes, it's called a Class 3 spacesuit. It's a training spacesuit. So you get in that suit, you seal it all up just like you would for a real spacewalk. So you're basically now in a bubble of air. And if we just threw you in a water tank, you would, even though the suit's quite heavy, you would just float. We mount weights on the suit in different places so that you can be made exactly neutrally buoyant. If scuba divers took you underwater and let go of you, you wouldn't drift upward and you wouldn't sink down and you also wouldn't tip or roll odd directions. And if you get that way out really nicely done, then your ability to maneuver around underwater, where we have full-size models or mock-ups, we call them, of the Hubble telescope or of the shuttle cargo bay, nowadays of the space station. So you have a full-size model of it and you're neutrally buoyant. You can maneuver around on that as close to the way you'll be able to move in zero gravity as it's possible to simulate.
Although you wrote that no simulation is perfect. Every simulation is flawed or deceptive in some way.
It's a ground rule you have to know when you're relying on simulation training. It's very, 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 very good. There is truly no better way to get your mind and body familiar with what's likely to happen and what you're going to need to concentrate on and how you're going to have to move. So there's no better way, but it is not a perfect way. And I'll give you an example. You always tether your tools on a spacewalk. There are a couple little hooks at different places in the suit. You hook onto the tool and you hook the tool onto, say, your wrist, the gauntlet of your glove. And in zero gravity, if that tether is a foot long, in zero gravity, every time you move your hand, motion of your arm is going to impel that tool and it's going to be wafting around, usually sort of languidly, on the end of that tether. In the pool, it's going to be dangling straight down from your wrist. In the pool, it's going to be tending, they got you weighed out perfectly, but then they handed you a 5-pound tool. That tool, as you move along, is going to be trying to tip your body continually. So those are small imperfections in the simulation that you need to think about. Well, you know, this tipping factor won't be there in the real world because the tipping is caused by the tool. But conversely, you need to think about, this happened to a friend of mine. He would goof around a little bit in the tank. When he wanted to put a new tool on a tether, he would swing it so that the tether sort of wafted up through the water. And at the top of that arc, he would snag it with his tether. It was a little bit of ballet with the tether. And he did that when he was in orbit on a real spacewalk. But in orbit, there wasn't the resistance of the water. The loop swung up just like it was supposed to, and he went for it with the tether hook. The loop floated into the tether, rebounded off the back of the hook, and was outside the hook before he snapped it close. So his timing was off, and suddenly his tool was floating away. And little things like that would surprise you. And what you wanted to do was keep them so small that they were little things you chuckled about and not big things that really messed something up.
October 11th, 1984, Kathy, that's the day you hear from Mission Control, Challenger Houston, you're a go for EVA, meaning your spacewalk. You are a go.
Yeah, it's a long ways getting to that point. It takes about 4 hours suiting up and checking things to reach that point. And that signal is the final switch that enables the emergency oxygen supply. So you're in the airlock. Suits are all sealed up. The airlock's sealed up. Got a little bit of air left in the airlock. It's not quite completely dumped out. And everybody on the ground does their final checks that all is good. And you do that final adjustment on your suit so that you've got an emergency oxygen supply, and then you do the final dumping of the air from the airlock, crank open the hatch, and swim on out into the void.
Although you were so mission-focused, you wrote in your book, Mission Commander Crippen said, "Take a moment to look at the Earth and appreciate where you are. I obediently pivoted my body away from the orbiter to look around. I was dangling from the handrail of a spaceship hundreds of miles above the Earth, which was gliding by below at 17,500 miles per hour. A burst of clashing thoughts flashed through my mind. I was in this absolutely extraordinary place, keenly aware of how deadly the environment outside my suit was. Yet being there seemed perfectly natural, and I felt utterly comfortable.
Yeah, Dave Liespa and I, he was my spacewalking buddy. We had trained to do the experiment that was the main reason we were going out. We had trained to get that down very tight on timeline. The way the flight was originally planned, the spacewalk was going to be pretty early, like around day three in this 10-day flight. And while we were outside in the cargo bay, this large remote sensing radar that we had on board would have to shut down. It put out so much power that the radiative energy might interfere with the computers on our spacesuits. Well, it was the top priority payload. So Dave and I were very drilled in, you need to get out and do it and get back because you're costing this primary payload time. So we had this really honed to a fine T. And our boss, Bob Crippen, he knew that very well.
The mission commander.
The mission commander. He knew that very well. This was his, you know, third flight experienced guy. And so he could see us just going out there, just like we were in the water tank, all very familiar. We've done this before. And he wanted to make sure at the very start that we just looked around and took in the fact that there are no scuba divers here. There's no support divers. That thing up there is not the surface of the water. It's the Earth. You know, just take a moment. It was a great moment. It was one of the, we had like two moments in the whole, I had two moments in the whole time to really just absorb the sight. That was one of them. And a little later in the flow of things where I was moving from one point to another, we had to pause things for a moment for an IMAX film scene. So those are the only two small snippets of time I was really able to just sort of take in where I was.
Must have been breathtaking.
It's amazing, yeah.
You flew a second time to deploy the Hubble Space Telescope, I think one of the most interesting missions NASA has ever undertaken. Tell us a little bit about Hubble and about that mission.
Hubble is it's an amazing machine. The root of the idea goes remarkably far back in time to really barely after World War II, before there even was a space age. And the design itself of this very complex machine that was designed from the outset to be maintainable by spacewalking astronauts, which is sort of an amazing enough thing to say in its own right. But that idea was formulated in the early 60s. There had been two spacewalks ever done, and both had been near disasters. And yet here's a team of engineers imagining a telescope the size of a school bus that, you know, space-suited astronauts will maintain and repair and upgrade over time. And then we got the assignment on our crew, STS-31 crew, to be the lucky folks that deliver it to orbit and start it on its mission life. But our work was preceded, and Bruce McCandless and I got to be a part of 5 years worth of the work that helped make sure that vague notion of maintain Hubble in orbit really was backed up with the tools and the equipment and the knowledge needed to do it.
Not just the size of a school bus, but with 400,000 parts and 26,000 miles of wiring. And then the idea was that it would be maintained not by returning it to Earth and working on it there, but in space, in orbit.
Yeah, but the evolution of that idea had a couple of stages. The initial version of it was the scientific instruments would be changeable in orbit, and things you knew were likely to fail, like batteries or tape recorders, fairly limited list. We'll do those things in orbit. So make sure they're easy sort of plug and play, instruments on guide rails, handles for astronauts in spacesuits to be able to work with, you know, bolts that are easy to get at, do all that. Make sure that's present on this fairly limited list. And about every 5 years, we will bring the telescope down and do the harder stuff. That was the first idea about maintaining it. And that idea, I learned is through my research and was surprised to learn, that idea lasted until the early 80s. That idea was banking on the shuttle being so inexpensive to fly and flying so often that it would be, you know, easy to do. And the shuttle fell short on those, on delivering on that. So by the early 80s, suddenly the Hubble guys look at all the other electronics on the telescope and realize, holy cow, now all these things have to be maintainable in orbit as well, because if this thing ever comes back to Earth, it's going to end up in a museum, not back in orbit. So it was an interesting challenge over those 5 years to try to retrofit and improve all the boxes on Hubble to make almost everything on the telescope maintainable.
And over time, though, Hubble had a rocky start, which we'll talk about in a minute. Hubble got better and better and better, more reliable, more precise, really a remarkable feat of engineering.
Well, it's coming up on having lived and provided twice its lifetime of observations and improving. You know, gets better with age. Yeah, it's true in spades with Hubble.
But there was a rocky start.
Hubble has about an 8-foot diameter primary mirror. It's actually a donut. There's a hole in the middle of it. So this big mirror catches all the light that comes in the front. It focuses the light on a smaller mirror that's about 2 feet diameter. And that smaller mirror shoots the beam of light down through the donut hole to where all the instruments have their receptors, their ports. The large mirror was fashioned to the wrong shape by a dimension that's about a 40th the thickness of a page in a hardcover book. It's a teeny amount, but it's an amount that should be doable for an astronomy-grade telescope. And the trick for how to fix it ended up rooting right back in that maintenance capability. It was not a matter of how do we fix the mirror. The first insight the engineers came up with was there's no way we're going to fix the mirror. The trick is how do we fix the light? So I've got 8 feet worth of bad light that's going up to the second mirror and coming down. I got to find a way to get into that light beam and fix it. And the recognition was, well, getting into the light beam is exactly what the scientific instruments do. The four big phone booth size, refrigerator size instruments, they sit corner to corner at the very bottom end of the telescope and they reach into that light beam. Take one of them out, put a box in the same size, replace it with a box the same size, that instead of having scientific receptors, has the optical elements, the lenses or the mirrors in Hubble's case, that can intercept the bad light and bounce it around to correct it into good light. Because although the mirror guys screwed up, they screwed up very, very precisely. And so you could do the math to calculate which mirrors of what shape and what size would turn the bad light back into good light.
And I think that was the key, right? That the failure was a precise failure, so there was a way to fix it.
That's right. The bad news is you screwed up, and the good news is you did it very precisely.
And then over time, of course, as you said, it's outlived its expected life and returned results, data, with precision that we never anticipated.
Never imagined.
Hubble helped us understand the age of the universe, the rate at which it's expanding, the presence of black holes in the center of virtually all galaxies.
It's been amazing in how it's let us look back in time and gain a deeper understanding of the cosmos. And one of my favorite things, we actually used a piece of it on the cover of the book. One of the observing campaigns is called the Hubble Deep Field and then the Ultra Deep Field. And this began with astronomers looking at the night sky as they knew it from their existing instruments on mountaintops, and identifying some empty patches. And said, you know, idea, are they really empty? I wonder if they're really empty. Let's aim Hubble at some of these empty patches and let it stare. Maybe it's full of stuff that's just too dim for the instruments we currently have to see it. So they let Hubble stare at these deep field patches, and it produced images that are just, it looks like some little girl's glitter bottle spilled onto the film. There's glorious specks and spots of light everywhere. And if you look really closely, specks and spots are not stars. Every one of the specks and spots is a galaxy. I mean, hundreds and thousands of galaxies everywhere you look.
NASA, I believe, has these photos on its website, and they are absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah, they're just stunning.
And so much of that is the work of Hubble.
Above the atmosphere, able to look in the ultraviolet, which you can't do from Earth at all. Now, with the corrected optics, quite precise, and right at the precision it was charged with meeting in the first place.
In your wonderful book, you use a great quote from James Odom. Who's James Odom, and what was his quote?
Jim Odom played a very significant role running the Hubble program at the Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, for a number of the years that I was working on the program. It's a wonderful quote. I was thrilled when I found it in my research. He said, trying to do, and I'm probably not exactly right in repeating it here, but trying to do astronomy from the Earth is like bird watching from the bottom of a lake. All you're going to see is wavy, distorted, vague representations of what a bird really is as you look through the turbulent dust and everything else of the layer of water that you've got above you. And the atmosphere is, in a sense, a layer of water. It's got particles in it. It's got turbulence. It warps the light. It scatters light.
In fact, Hubble was put into orbit twice as high as most satellites, which means that when you deployed Hubble, you had a spectacular view of the Earth.
It's twice as high as most shuttle payloads, that's for sure. 332 nautical miles, I think, was our final altitude when we got to orbit. And that's to get it far, far above the atmosphere. But mainly because Hubble, you know, how does Hubble position itself? How does it hold still? It doesn't have rocket thrusters. They would spit stuff out that would end up coating the mirror. So Hubble has gyroscopes, number of gyroscopes that spin and uses the torque from those gyros and the momentum in those gyros to slowly move itself. It doesn't move fast. If you have an old style analog watch, the fastest Hubble can move is about the speed that your minute hand moves around the dial, but it can hold very precise positions and it can hold very still without, you know, vibrations and rumblings.
Kathy, your third and final flight, STS-45, was in March of 1992. And there's a passage in your book that really struck me. 2 days prior to liftoff, so this would have been on March 22nd, 1992, you and your father took a long walk together. And you write, "Just as we had done before each of my prior flights, though it was never said aloud, we both knew that this was our quote-unquote just-in-case walk, the moments, words, and hugs he would cling to if his baby girl, that was you, never came back."
Yeah, so it's a lot for families to do. It's always easier to be the person doing something than to watch someone you love doing something that's high stakes or risky. And it's very hard on families to stand there and know that their loved one is riding bombs for a living.
And in fact, you saw that. You lost colleagues and friends to a tragedy in the space program.
Yes, I was still in the program at the time of the Challenger accident. And it was a devastating blow to everyone, obviously to none more so than the families whose loved ones did not come home. But everyone's world turns upside down and is just deep, deep sadness for a long, long time frame getting past something like that.
Who were your colleagues that you lost in the Challenger disaster?
Well, four of the Challenger crew were my classmates. Mission Commander Dick Scobie, Mission Specialist Judith Resnick, and Ron McNair, and L. Onizuka. Dick's number two, his pilot, was Mike Smith. He was one of my favorite guys from the class one notch junior to us. And then, of course, famously, that was the flight that was carrying Krista McAuliffe, the first meant to be the first teacher in space, and also Greg Jarvis, an aerospace engineer from one of the companies that had a satellite on the flight.
That must have been a very difficult time for NASA and for the men and women who worked in the program.
It was a truly horrible time with a very long and sad aftermath.
I'm glad you spoke of them. And I think everyone understands that the risk that explorers take can be extraordinary at times, but that there is a benefit at the end.
I believe so.
Later in your career, Kathy, when you left NASA, you served as the head of NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, part of the Department of Commerce. Tell us about NOAA.
NOAA is a really great, underappreciated agency in our federal government. It's the sea and sky, oceans and atmosphere. My title as administrator was also Undersecretary for Oceans and Atmosphere. Its roots go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, who established the Survey of the Coast in, I think it was 1807 or thereabouts, to provide nautical charts for this new young nation that was so dependent on maritime commerce. And then through the rest of the 1800s, at one point a weather service was established originally in the Army Signal Corps, eventually pulled out of the Army and set up on its own as the Weather Bureau. And like Jefferson's Survey of the Coast, the origins of the Weather Service are also very commerce and safety oriented. Transcontinental Railroad, farm settlement of the Central Plains, farmers and ranchers out in upper Midwest needing to have weather information to keep their herds safe, to manage their crops, to keep the railroads running. Then again, a little later in the 1800s, Bureau of Commercial Fisheries is established because at that time the problem was there was more protein supply readily available in the country's oceans than we were using and the population needed it. In 1970, President Nixon signed an act into law that pulled those pieces, Survey of the Coast, Weather, Fisheries, and some others, under one umbrella and called it NOAA. You know, Earth systems science had evolved to the point by that stage in 1970 that it was realized you gotta put these pieces together if you're going to get the deep understanding of how the weather works, how climate works, how fisheries work, because they all interact with each other. You got the weather guys over here and the fish guys over here. They don't even know how to talk to each other, much less what the common scientific questions are. And so NOAA now is all those things under one roof: the National Weather Service, marine fisheries, still the nautical charting bunch, a research arm, the weather satellites, the country's operational weather satellites. Those are actually NOAA satellites, not NASA satellites.
Our ability, for instance, to predict weather has gotten better and better and better, which means, in addition to public safety, positive effects for commerce and agriculture, makes life easier for a lot of people.
You know, weather data really pervade much more of our daily life than we ever think about. Your point on commerce, just one little case in point, a big box retailer gets from a private sector enterprise that takes NOAA data, they get a tailored forecast on a weekly basis. I think it comes to them on Tuesday, that gets driven down into store by store and product code by product code. I mean, it gets to the weather psychology. This coming up weekend is going to be the first warm weekend of the spring. Move all these products over here. They're going to sell themselves. Put these things on your end caps. Don't spend any money on advertising for this. Really sort of driving the commercial efficiency of their retail operation based on the weather and how people will respond to the weather.
Thanks to the National Weather Service.
Thanks to the National Weather Service and NOAA.
Absolutely fascinating. Do you look up at the heavens and marvel that you were there?
I do. I'd love to see the space station go overhead and remember that that little bright dot has half a dozen people in it. I don't know as many of them as well now. I'm that far removed. But it makes me think back to one particular time that I was in orbit, and we were crossing the line, it's called the Terminator, between the daylit side of the Earth and the dark side of the Earth. The space shuttle and station go around basically an hour and a half. So if you're an astronaut, you get 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets in a day, not just one each. But I was crossing from the daylit side to the night side, and we're high enough up that we're still illuminated by the sun a fair distance over the dark side of the Earth. And the shoe dropped. It sort of clicked to me as I looked down at the lights on the Earth. And I realized we're still bathed in sunlight. Somebody down there, some little kid down there, might right now be looking up and pointing up and saying, "Mommy, look, a satellite." And he's pointing at me. I'm that satellite. And so whenever I see the station go over, I think back to that moment and how amazing it was to realize I'm the satellite going over somebody's head.
Kathy Sullivan, thank you so much for spending some time with us and as well for your extraordinary service to our country.
Thank you. Service has been a pleasure and this has been a fun conversation. Thanks.
Thanks to Kathy Sullivan and the wonderful folks at Brainstorm Media in Columbus, Ohio for hosting our podcast. Kathy is an explorer and a pioneer, an oceanographer and a scientist, an astronaut and an American hero. Selected as one of the first female astronauts in NASA history, Kathy flew three missions on the space shuttle and became, in 1984, the first American woman to walk in space. In June of 2020, after this episode was recorded, Kathy became the first woman to reach the deepest spot in the ocean, a nearly 7-mile descent to the Challenger Deep in the Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific Ocean. That makes Kathy the only person ever to walk in space and to dive to the ocean's deepest known point. If you like this episode, please let us know by leaving us a 5-star rating on whatever app you use to listen, and ask your friends to subscribe. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, and every major listening app, as well as msnbc.com/theoath. If you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of the podcast, and you will find the episode notes, including some details you might have missed. If you have any thoughtful criticism, feedback, or questions about this episode or others, please email us at theoathpodcast@gmail.com. That's all one word, theoathpodcast@gmail.com. And though I cannot personally respond to every email, please know that I read each one of them, and I really do appreciate it. The Oath is a production of NBC News and of MSNBC. This podcast was produced by Fannie Cook and the wonderful team of Fannie Cohen, Nick Bannon, and Rob Hebert. I am fortunate to work with them. Olivia Cruiser provided excellent production support, as always. Our senior producer is Allison Bailey, and Steve Lichtai is our executive producer. This is The Oath with Chuck Rosenberg. Thank you so very much for listening.